Welcome back to Remember What's Next, the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro, an author, educator, and world-renowned Israeli tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we began by exploring Jewish unity, but quickly pivoted to address the world and Jewish experiences in history post-October 7th. We are having conversations and updates on what is happening on the ground in Israel, as well as what is happening to Jews in the diaspora, and turning to our history to try to understand how to navigate what is happening moment to moment and to predict or see what is coming down the pipeline. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. Welcome to Remember What's Next. Welcome back, everyone, to Remember What's Next. Rabbi Ken Spiro, how are you doing?
Good to be back after we had a break there a few weeks. I was in America on a speaking tour, so we missed a few weeks of putting out information. Thankfully, there's no shortage of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. What did it feel like being in America since being in Israel? Like, what was the vibe that you ran into?
Yeah, so I mean, I traveled a lot of places, way too many flights. I mean, I personally didn't feel anything. No one made any comments to me or anything. I walk around with a kippah everywhere, so it's not an issue. People are still, a lot of the original shock that people were suffering from has cooled down somewhat because it's become the norm now, unfortunately. But the people are still very open and interested and awake and wanting to try and understand what is going on, you know, in the Middle East and what's going on with Israel and what's going to be is the big question a lot of people have. And I think that's like subdivided into two things. What's going to be with Israel and the Hamas and how's that going to play out with Hezbollah? And also what's going to be with, you know, how things going to be in the world? The anti-Semitism's up there. Everyone's on edge. Everyone's got security. Every synagogue I went to has armed guards. It's kind of creepy. That's stuff that we never saw growing up.
Yep. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think we can just feel a general continuing sense of unease and unsafety that just doesn't seem to be abating at all. Especially, I think, because of everything that's going on campus, that is continuing to just astound us in the absolute vitriol against Jews. Et cetera, et cetera. So I think what we wanted to dig into today maybe helps us to be able to understand a little bit of what we're talking about, also in light of what happened recently in Russia with the attack on the concert there that is being claimed to have something to do with ISIS. So we wanted to dig into a little bit on the overview and the history of radical Islam. And to begin with a couple of caveats, we're trying to understand this as a way to understand the Middle East, which is not, as you said, just about the Arab-Israeli conflict, to try to understand the relationship between Jews and Islam and Muslims, which, I think we're going to see some differences there. You know, do we see them as our cousins? Do we see them as our enemy? How do we understand that in a way that is balanced and informed? And to try to just break it down a little bit, because there's so much news and so many terms being thrown around related to who we're dealing with. I think most of us don't necessarily have a deeper picture of what exactly we're talking about. So where should we start with this? How can we jump in? Where's the right beginning point?
Well, I think we should define some terms, right. Like just understanding the word Islam, Muslim, Arab. They tend to be used interchangeably without doing a course, you know, a whole semester course on, you know, the history of Islam in the Arab world. most, you know, Islam begins, this is the short version. Islam begins as a faith of the nomadic Arabic speaking people of the Arabian Peninsula. And that's, by the way, where Arabs are indigenous to. Not the coast of the Mediterranean, by the way, not North Africa. It's the Arabian Peninsula.
Which is about where? Like, where would we find
that? Saudi Arabia, the Red Sea, that whole area, the, you know, UAE, Bahrain, Dubai. This is the heart of the Arab world, where Islam appears in the 7th century and spreads very dramatically. Today it remains the fastest spreading religion in the world. And it's gotten out to places like Indonesia. That takes another 700 years. But well, most they're definitely Christian Arabs, very small percentage. The earliest Christian communities are in the Middle East. They begin in Israel. So that's where Christianity begins. But most Arabs are Muslims, but most Muslims aren't Arabs. That's like a really important thing to understand.
Okay, so that say most, that again. Most Arabs.
Arabs are Muslim.
Are Muslim.
I can divide up into many different modern nation states today, but Arabs. The definition of an Arab is a little bit hard. Is it, you know, it's not a race per se, but Arabic speaking people. Okay, often the use of the language is one of the classic terms used. Ways anthropologists define who are Arabs, people who speak Arabic. Although that's spread to other places.
And we know, for instance, we know because some Arabs are Christian, some are Coptic Christian, some are, you know, Zoroastrian. There are other faiths that are part of the Arab world, but most of the Arab world is Muslim, which means they ascribe to the religion of Islam. Is that correct? Okay.
Exactly. But most Muslims aren't Arabs. That's point number one. Only 30% approximately of the Muslim world, of an estimated, 1.8, 1.9 billion people, something like 25% of the world's population today. But only 30% of those, to the tune of, I think it's like about 350 million, are actually Arabs. The largest Islamic nation in the world is, surprisingly, Indonesia, which is over there in the Pacific. Those are Indonesians, are neither linguistically, ethnically, or in any way Arab. And, you know, India, ironically enough, which is a Hindu state, you know, basically the British allowed modern India to be founded in 1947. India's Muslim minority is 400 million people, making India, which is a Hindu state's Muslim population, the second largest Muslim population in the world. Wow. Pakistan, which was the breakaway state, founded when India was formed as the Muslim state, which is much smaller than India, is also, none of these people are Arabs. They're Indian, you know. Turks are not Arabs, nor are Iranians, the Persians, the Shiites who are living over there. It's a different ethnic group, a different language, a different history, but they're all united by a faith. I believe there are something like 22 states of the Arab League. Those are Arab states of the more or less the Middle East. And there's 50 plus nations that have Islam as their dominant faith. So we have to be clear on what we're talking about. A good percentage of the world's population that might be religiously sort of united. That's another topic, because we tend to say Muslims. The word Islam means to submit. The word Muslim means submission. Islam is one to submit. What are you submitting to? Islam is submission. You're submitting to, in Islamic thought, I'm not a Muslim, but I think I understand the concept. It's the word of God, who Muslims call Allah, as transmitted through who they believe is their prophet, who's Muhammad. So it's the whole, but within that, we also have to understand that there's a lot of different groups. I mean, the vast majority of Muslims in the world are called Sunni Muslims. Sunni means the way.
So before we go, the same way other religions have different groups, meaning like under, say, Christianity, there's Catholicism, there's Christianity, there's different types of Christianity and different types of Catholics. So the same even in Judaism, that we have a couple of different, you know, divisions, Ashkenaz, Sephardi, right, Reform, Conservative, whatever, you know, however you define those things. So it is under the umbrella of Islam or being Muslim, but there are different now branches underneath that umbrella. So what are the branches and who are they?
So, I mean, there's a lot of little ones we're not going to go into. You know, there's like Ahmadiyya, there's a bunch of little ones that are relatively small. The big groups to look at are called Sunni and Shiite. And Sunni are about 85% of the Muslim world, and most Muslim countries are Sunni. The Shiite population, which is about 15%, is primarily centered in Iran, Iraq. There are a few other countries that have smaller Shiite populations. For instance, in Israel, which is I'm talking about the Palestinian population, Israeli Arabs, 20% of Israel's Arab, they're overwhelmingly, with a few exceptions, they're overwhelmingly Sunni Muslims. Mm-hmm. And they consider themselves to be the Orthodox Muslims. Shiites are a breakaway group, so to speak. It goes back to the major disagreement is over the leadership of the faith. in the year 680 in Iraq, there was a battle called Karbala, where Hussein, who was the son of Ali, who is also the son-in-law of Muhammad, so Hussein is the grandson of Muhammad, is killed in the Battle of Karbala. And that's the Sunni-Shiite split. And the basic issue, without making it too complicated, is that Shiites believe that the leader of Islam, the Imam, has to be a blood descendant of Muhammad. Whereas Caliph, which is the idea of the Caliphate, is a term we hear thrown out around a lot, which means a successor, more or less, in Sunni thinking, does not have to be. And that, by the way, and what you talked about correctly, that, you know, there's different within Judaism, there's Ashkenazic and Sephardic, and there's different expressions. You know, in the Christian world, you have Catholic, Protestant. Now you have a myriad of breakaway. There's so many different kinds of Christians in America, I can't keep track.
Right.
But the thing we have to appreciate too, which is very important to understand, especially the colors, the Middle East in particular, is Ashkenazi and Sephardi might eat different food on Pesach and stuff like that. But there's not really big fights over stuff. There really isn't. There've been social issues in the modern state of Israel about Ashkenazi power elites founding the state. Right. Maybe not being so nice to their poorer Sephardi brethren coming from the Middle East. In the Christian world, when you had the split of first the Catholic Church, which was the only church, into then the Eastern Orthodox Church, and that subsplits, and then the birth of Protestantism 500 years ago, that will lead to massive religious wars. Hmm. And you see this all the way up to today, literally until, and it's still, the tension is still there in places like Northern Ireland, where the British will basically take Protestants who are not the really indigenous population of Ireland, settle them in Northern Ireland, and there'll be wars going on, you know, the IRA, the Sinn Féin, all this stuff. This is, so you see, but massive amount of violence in Europe, which has basically ceased. It doesn't really exist anymore. What people really need to understand is how deep is the divide between the Sunni and Shiite world. How that Sunni don't even really consider Shiites to be real. Ironically, I always say people, when they think of, like, if you ask a Westerner who's not well-educated, who's the more extreme? They go, Shiites, and I think of Iran. But the reality is, The Sunni look at the Shiites as like the Reform Jews. Like, they're the Reform ones. They broke away. They're not serious. They're not really Muslim. So I've heard them say that. I'm Muslim. Some of them say that. Either.
Right.
So, but that leads to tremendous animus and absolute and open violence and hostility that manifests itself all the way into the intestine struggles that are going on in the Middle East today between the superpower of the Shiite world, which is basically Iran, backing all of these proxy armies in Syria and Iraq, backing Hezbollah. And what's interesting is even though historically these guys are arch enemies because they share the common enemy of hating Israel, you now have the weird alliance, as we say in the Middle East, my enemy's enemy is my friend, of like Iran, which basically creates and supports Hezbollah, and Hezbollah openly supporting, as is Iran, Hamas, which is a Sunni Arab organization, which comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is another different story altogether, modern Islamic history.
Fascinating. So let's divide these into, say, two camps now so that we can understand the players, because this was something that was helpful for me when you sort of laid this out. So if we were to imagine the Shiite camp, who believes that the leadership should be a blood descendant of Muhammad, and by the way, is that the case? Is the actual leader of Shiite?
You don't have the Imam disappeared. He's supposed to come back. He's not. There is no recognized caliph in the Islamic world. Really, the sultans of Turkey, that the centralized leadership of the Islamic world has really fallen apart. Right. Early Islam, if you study, you had the first four caliphs who were like recognized as the righteous ones, and then it kind of splintered. And literally since the 8th century, Islam has been fractionalized and fighting over who truly represents, even in the Sunni world, who truly is leader of the Sunni world. That still goes on until today. So you don't have any physical, it's not two people running around with like crowns on their heads or turbans or anything like that, saying that I am the true leader of Islam. It's more theological. So who should, in the messianic era, let's say, of Islam, the leader, when he comes back, the Imam or the Caliph, will be, in the case of the Shiites, he'll be the Imam will return and reestablish his dominance
and somehow be blood related and et cetera, et
cetera. Well, that's the issue.
So on the Shiite side, we had, which is the smaller population side, that's Iran, that's Iraq, and that's Hezbollah. Those are kind of the main headers on the Shiite.
We have a few other places, Sunni, by the way.
Sorry?
We have a few of the smaller Islamic states in the Gulf are Shiite populations too, by the way, but they're like small. They're, yeah.
Okay. And then on the Sunni side is we find Hamas, Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, I believe, is that ISIS is Sunni. And then the countries are like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, these bigger Arabic countries who are also Sunni Muslim. So did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, also it's North Africa, it's the Middle East, you know, these countries, most of the countries, like most of the Arab countries are majority or totally Sunni states, like North Africa is like Sunni. So, but in the Middle East, yes, there's, when you talk about the Arab Islamic world, there's, you know, places like Jordan, that's a Sunni country. But the big players in the Middle East are basically Egypt, which is the largest Arab Islamic state. Not the largest Muslim state, but the largest Arab Islamic state, although very poor. And then you have a country like Saudi Arabia, which is a very large state with very few people and a lot of money. And there's also kind of, in addition to the Sunni Shiite rivalry over who's going to dominate the Middle East, and these different religious faiths view their physical domination as a proof of their spiritual correctness. Whoever wins, you know, obviously God is on their side. You have Sunni countries that have been, and these are, I'm talking about modern conflicts, post-World War I, World War II, and the modern Middle East is created, we're also kind of duking it out, not necessarily fighting wars with each other, but trying to outmaneuver each other into who can have more influence in the future of the Middle East, which is basically, mm-hmm. as you said correctly, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, which is not an Arab state, but is a very significant, in terms of countries with large economy, very significant military, actually a member of NATO, the only, you know, that's pretty unbelievable. So they're kind of doing this dance on their own about influence and who can take credit and have influence here. And even in Israel, you see this all the time, who can pour money into different things to show that they are the sort of the supporters of the Palestinian issue and the holy sites in Jerusalem. You know, Jordan has been very involved in that, but you see Morocco has made a big move to try and do it also. And Turkey's also in there fixing up mosques in Israel, buying buildings.
How does Qatar fit into this? What is Qatar?
So Qatar is, I believe, I believe it has a Shiite population. I think it, that's something I could even, let me see. I'm gonna ask my phone right now. Because
Qatar is really one of the countries that has come to the forefront. Number one for, harboring Hamas leaders and having them live in their country. Plus, when people started to look into the funding for many of the Ivy League universities, Qatar was kind of at the top of the list as one of the countries that has been funding a certain radical or, you know, in identity-based ideology on campuses. And so, you know, and they're trying to help broker the hostage deal, which is fascinating. So what is Qatar and how does it play a part in things?
It's interesting. I was looking to check that I was right. I don't like to say things that I'm sure about them, but it's citizens make up 11% of the population. So it's mostly, as many of these Gulf states have mostly foreign workers and their population is very small. While non-citizens account for approximately 89%, most citizens are Sunni Muslims and almost all others are Shiite Muslims. So there's a large Shiite population there, but they Sunni dominate. And I think that is the situation in a few other of these little states, these Gulf states, as to the role they play. You know, it's interesting. They're kind of an outlier state. Most of these little Gulf states, like UAE, is trying to play a more moderate role. They've sort of lined themselves. They do a very interesting balancing act between, you know, you have Al Jazeera, and they kind of play a neutral role. But the reality is they're very much involved, especially in the financial infrastructure of a lot of radical Islamic movements like Hamas. And we know that all the Hamas leadership is living in the lap of luxury in a place like Qatar. So it's a very interesting situation that they find themselves in. And they have been at odds with countries like Saudi Arabia, by the way, precisely because of their close affiliation with, like, my enemy's enemy's my friend, with their relationship with, Iran. Everything is complicated within the big picture. There's multiple little relationships. It's like kind of a dysfunctional family with, I get along with this cousin and that aunt, but not that brother. And my brother gets along with his sister, but I don't get along with her. So that's kind of like the Middle East. It's so much more complicated politically, historically, financially and in terms of power and control and relationships. It really takes hours to try and figure out what's going on. And that's always shifting.
To be honest, it does sound a little bit like the Toronto Jewish community. Because when I came into the Toronto Jewish community, I was like, why doesn't this person talk to this person? How come they won't go to each other's shuls? Why don't they talk to each other? How come this thing funds this but not that? How come the whole thing is just so rife with
how would you answer that? There's a lot of history there. That's what you'd say.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is the same thing.
There's a lot of history. Yeah, so fascinating. So in terms of, I guess what you're saying is then when Hamas and Hezbollah, you know, Hamas, which is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hezbollah, which is a branch, say, of Iran, get together to fight Israel, it's literally what you're saying, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend, because normally Hamas and Muslim Brotherhood are Sunni and Hezbollah and Iran are Shiite. And normally those two people would never sit at the same table together, never mind unify to fight like a commonly perceived enemy. So it's a fascinating overlap where it's very hard to know who's on what team.
Yeah. And by the way, those relationships change all the time. You can see already the fact that Saudi Arabia is reestablishing contact with Iran, even though they hate each other, is precisely because they view America, especially now, as being extremely weak and wishy-washy. And they're waiting to see how it's going to play out with Israel, because Israel is really the peacekeeper in the Middle East. I know it sounds weird. Israel is the source of all? Not at all. The reality is it's Israel as the strongest military in the Middle East, which is, even though they don't say it, they maintain the nuclear ambiguity policy, but Israel is a mega force to contend with. And Israel has intervened in the past to prevent the destruction of other Arab states, like it did keeping Jordan intact when Syria would have taken it over. So they're kind of waiting to see how Israel is going to emerge, because they know the real struggle is between Iran and Israel. And if Israel comes out on top and crushes Hamas, that's a blow against, you know, Iran, one of Iran's biggest proxies in its war, in its attempt to start a multi-front war with Israel, surrounded on all sides, whether it's through little militia armies in Syria and Iraq, and then with Hezbollah in the north, which is effectively running, to a large extent, Lebanon. So they're kind of waiting, but in the meantime, they're hedging their bets. It's like you could just see how it's working. We don't want to antagonize, because it could be that we're going to be in a worse place. We got to see how this plays out, which is why also the Abraham Accords haven't moved forward. Once things calm down, and if Israel crushes Hamas and Hezbollah is also put in its place, you'll probably see within a pretty short period of time, depends who's president in America also, who will push it. Finally, an accord made between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which will be the greatest.
Which was on the way to happening before this happened. It was one of the reasons they say that October 7th happened when it did. Right. It was because it was literally on the cusp of Saudi Arabia and Israel stepping into a historically significant peace agreement.
Right. It's a titanic shift in the reality of what would have been. That's a game changer for the Middle East. Saudi Arabia buys in, it's like, game over, because people really need to understand. They don't, because there's so many useful idiots running around screaming from the river to the sea and don't even know what river sea it's talking about, who have no information about anything, don't even know the river that's outside their own backyard. They don't realize that no one really gives a squat about the Palestinians. In the Arab world, I'm talking about. Westerners care about them a lot more. They're just a handy tool to be used in the maneuvering of the bigger picture of the Middle East and the power struggles. So, but by the way, if Israel were...
And I think the pain of that statement even is knowing that they only care about Palestinians when they're in Gaza, whereas when Syria or Lebanon or all these other places slaughter their Palestinian citizens or torture them or put them in concentration camps, like, no one cares. So it's a bit, you know, even saying that people in the West care more about Palestinians is also a bit untrue, because they only care about them when they're fighting with Jews.
That's also true. And you said correctly that, you know, that the refugee issue, where Israel, you know, about 800,000 Sephardic Jews were ethnically cleansed from the Middle East, all the countries that surround Israel between basically 1948 and 1967, with losing everything, and were absorbed by Israel and make up the very large Sephardic population, Middle Eastern population of Israel of today. The Palestinians who fled for various reasons because of the war, and I don't want to go into the whole history of the refugee issue, but have been kept in a state of limbo literally for, you know, 75 plus years. So they're the pawns in the game. I mean, I don't view them as, I don't want to get into this topic now, but they could have already completely rectified their situation had they accepted and agreed to live side by side with Israel. You got the Jews living next to you. This is the superpower creative economy of not only the Middle East, but the world in terms of technology and startup. They could have had 100% employment, the best educated and most successful, Arab population in the Middle East could have been the Palestinian Arab population. Gaza could have been like French Riviera.
Yeah, for sure.
And unfortunately, they blew it there because they're so brainwashed into hate and destruction. And they're not for anything except destroying Israel.
Their leadership is, is deeply unfortunate in terms of not really caring more about their billion-dollar homes in Qatar than, whether their people have food and education and safety and security. Yeah, it's a horrible situation in that way. Sorry about that. I'm just turning my phone off. Okay, so where do we go from here? So we've more or less defined our terms. We've talked about what is Islam and the word Muslim. We've talked about how most Arabs are Muslims, but most Muslims aren't Arab, that the larger Arab populations are in Indonesia, India, Pakistan, Turkey, those types of places. The difference between Sunni and Shiite, which are the two football teams, for lack of a better term, underneath Islam and Muslims, and how those generally don't even come to the same table. But when it comes to dealing with Israel, many of those enemies will become friends in order to have a united front against Israel in some way. So where do we end up now where, like, for instance, with what Hamas is doing, do the Sunni and Shiites unite unilaterally right now in the Arab world against Israel? Are we basically facing 22 Arab states surrounding Israel that all want its total destruction? How are they responding to Hamas, and what does that look like?
Right. So I think even before we go to that, I think it's important to understand where because what's going on with Israel is kind of a byproduct of the kind of titanic forces that have shaped the Islamic world, not necessarily Arab world, in history, and how that has impacted on Islam and how it's interpreted. We use the term radical Islam, for instance. You can't say some of these terms now. It's not PC. But the reality is, and it's a correct thing to say, most Muslims are not, we don't call them radicals, but there's a lot of, there's Rashid al-Rahman, who's a Saudi Arabian journalist. He had a very scary, he's coming from an Arab journalist, a big Saudi Arabian journalist. He said, most Arabs are not terrorists, but most terrorists are Arabs, or Muslims, he would say. Most Muslims are not terrorists, but most terrorists are Muslim. A good percentage of what is called terrorism, and we just saw in Russia now, a huge percentage of it, of the conflicts and the terrorism in the world, is coming out of the Islamic, not necessarily Arab world, which is not to label all Muslims as Arabs. All Muslims as terrorists. There are plenty of moderate, normal, nice Muslim people in the world and plenty of Muslim states that are not radicalized. But how did it get to the place that we're in now is a combination of, first of all, understanding two things. Again, and they're all, each of them is a class by itself. One of them is the thing you're never allowed to talk about, but which it's the elephant in the room, which is the mainstream Islamic worldview, which can be interpreted in a very extreme way. And it can be interpreted in a more moderate way, but there's certain aspects of Islam which could make it quite expansionist and aggressive if interpreted that way. And by the way, all first we have to appreciate, Ellie, that all monotheistic faiths, of which Judaism is the mothership and then Christianity and Islam are the offshoots, are particularistic in their worldview. Mm-hmm. Not like the ancient pagan world, which may have been very immoral and pretty licentious, but nonetheless was very inclusive because they swapped gods like baseball cards. There's no idea of like, I'm right, you're wrong, but it could be, I'm powerful and you're weak, so I conquer you, but it's not like you're wrong. It's very much like no one really cared about ideology that much. Huh. But particularist faiths believe in ideas, one God, one truth, and one standard of reality, and that God acts in history. That tends to create a worldview that is very kind of narrow and less flexible in what it's willing to accept from the outside. Now, Judaism, of these three faiths, by the way, is the most flexible. Why? Because A, we are not into physical conquest of the world. That's not a Jewish thing. I always jokingly say the only Jewish empire in history has been Hollywood. And that's not a source of Jewish values. Yeah.
Not so much. We've done a pretty bad job at this point.
Right. So we're not into physical conquest. We're not into spiritual conquest. We make it hard to convert. It's a really long process. 6 right. years.
We're not proselytizing. We're not trying to make people Jewish. We have no interest in doing that.
And as it says in the Talmud, the righteous of the nations of the world have a place in the world to come. You don't have to be Jewish to go to heaven. You can be, you can look very religious and not do very well in the world to come if you're like, you know, if you're not a good person as a very supposedly orthodox looking Jew. But right, God judges us to a very significant extent on, you know, how we act, not just our matter of what we believe. Christianity, historically, without doing a whole class on it, does not believe in the physical conquest of the world, which doesn't mean that there haven't been plenty of Christian rulers in the name of Jesus who have gone and conquered all kinds of things, like Ferdinand and Isabella and the Portuguese in the New World, right, starting in the late 15th, early 16th centuries. But it's not a physical, right, it's not an imperative religiously to physically conquer. But they do believe in spiritual conquest, meaning proselytizing.
Right.
Sending out people
that
to
eventually
spread.
Everyone should end up Christian and believing in Jesus. And that's one of the things
only
that
way,
needs
right,
to happen.
And the only way to salvation is through belief in Jesus. He died for your sins. Islam behaves, there's a great book by Ephraim Karsh called Islamic Imperialism, behaves just as much, if not more, like an empire than it does as a faith. As a matter of fact, you could argue that Islam has been more actively in history involved in physical conquest than spiritual conquest for economic reasons. Islam, from its very inception, pardon my siren out my window, Islam from its very inception has been into the idea of conquest, because what I'm going to explain now is not radical Islamic worldview. It's Islamic, as we say in Hebrew, hashkafa, their worldview. Islam believes, basically, that Judaism got it wrong, you know, Christians got it wrong. Muhammad came along, and he, in the 7th century, he's the final prophet. He got it right. Okay. So the whole world is supposed to recognize that he is the seal, like the, you know, the final stamp, the seal of the prophets. The whole world is therefore, since the Muslims got it right, and there's no one coming after him, the whole world is to become Muslim, to submit to the word of God as transmitted through Muhammad. And the whole world is supposed to become what's called Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam. But until that
meaning similarly to Christians, where they say eventually everybody should convert to Christianity in order to be saved, that in Islam they have a similar idea that eventually, because Islam is the last, you know, religion, and this, like, this was the final stamp, that eventually, in order for the world to reach its best potential, everybody eventually has to become Muslim. Is that correct?
Well, I say best potential is, it's like the will of God. This is what God wants. As the Muslims would say, inshallah, you know, God willing, that's the way it's going to be. So this is what God wants. God wants the world to accept his word as transmitted through Muhammad. But until that time, the world's going to be divided, because the world has not become Dar al-Islam yet. Only, you know, whatever, you know, 25%, the 75% left to still do. So until that time, the world's going to be divided into Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, the house of war, like kharab, sword in Hebrew. And through what idea is the world of war, the world of the infidel, brought into the world of Islam? Through the idea of jihad. So jihad means struggle. It can be interpreted in different ways, by the way. It can be like an internal struggle, like your evil inclination. But the way it's generally interpreted in Islamic law and how it's expressed by political thinkers is external struggle. It's called jihad fi sabilillah, Allah, struggle in the path of God. To bring Dar al-Harb, the world of the sword, into the world of Islam, which means it's viewed as a deterministic, historical, theological, physical imperative to basically conquer the world. Now, Islam, by the way, unlike Christianity, Judaism is very legalistic. Christianity is not. It's very theological. It's creed, what you believe over deed. Islam has a very highly developed legal sense and a worldview. And an Islamic worldview, non-Muslims, because they have to be legally defined, are basically broken into two groups of people. They're pagans. Pagans have no future in Islam. You can't practice paganism under Islam. You can convert to Islam, become a slave, or die. But non-Muslim monotheists, and this is a term that everyone should Google, it's called dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, it's like a protected person. It sounds nice, but it's actually a little more complicated than that, a little darker than that. Dhimmi means, and Dhimmi are basically Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, a few other groups. Because you believe in one God and you're not a pagan, we let you live and practice your faith. But because you're not a Muslim, you are subject to quite a large amount of discriminatory legislation, wearing a special sign or a badge to designate you as a non-Muslim, stepping into the gutter when a Muslim is walking on the street, dismounting from an animal, not to be hired, not bearing arms in the presence of a Muslim, not not being able to testify in court against them, not being able to employ a Muslim as a servant. And of course, very important, which plays a huge role in Islamic spread, you have to pay a poll tax, which is called the jizya, a submission tax. You can read more about this. You can read about Khaybar and the Pact of Omar. If you want to read up on this, Khaybar is a Jewish town that was conquered by Muhammad in 628. And the Pact of Omar is kind of like the theological basis for the Islamic relationship with non-Muslims. But it's kind of institutionalized, second class, almost apartheid-like relationship, which, by the way, in the history of Islam, sometimes been adhered to very strictly and sometimes not been adhered to very strictly.
Right.
And when it's not adhered to strictly, like in the golden age of Spain from the 8th to the 11th century in the Umayyad dynasty that ruled Spain, and you had a great relationship between three groups, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, you have one of the greatest symbiosis in the history of human history of the last 3,000 years. Of the best of all creativity coming together with three groups of people allowed to freely interact and be creative in a very open society, thus proving that Islam can be extremely open and innovative if it chooses to be so, but it has more to do with less strictly keeping Islamic law. It's more like that, because we're kind of ignoring those things that worked out really, really well. And by the way, 1,000 years ago, when 90% of the Jews in the world spoke Arabic as their first language and were living in the Middle East and in places like Spain and North Africa, it was a heck of a lot better being a Jew in those places than living 1,000 years ago in medieval Europe. Right. Which is kind of like hell. It really was not anywhere near as nice. It wasn't as dark as they say. The Dark Ages were not so dark, but the Islamic world, in terms of reintroducing classical knowledge of Greece and Rome back into the world, and astronomy and mathematics and science and medicine and you name it, was very far advanced. But the irony is, David Price Jones wrote a book called The Close Circle. And it was an eye-opener for me, because he shows that whereas the Christian world, like I mentioned 1,000 years ago, it weaned itself out of, with the collapse of the Roman Empire and the collapse of central authority, Europe kind of degenerated. Cities fell apart. You know, the populations dropped. Standards of living. So, you know, everything, the food chain broke down. Everything was much worse. But then as Europe slowly gets out of there, we get to the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and Europe moves away from that backward dark period, we get to the modern world today of Europe, which is, by the way, very enlightened, open, developed economically and politically, very much less religious than they used to be 1,000 years ago.
Right.
Christians were, your primary identity was your Christian faith. Meanwhile, Islam has really, in the last 500 years, with the exception of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, really gone backwards. I mean, Spain is reconquered by the Christians in 1492, so that bastion of culture kind of collapses, and a lot of that is lost. And the Ottoman Empire will emerge as a superpower country, the last great one. But the Arab world did retrograde. It did what opposite of Europe did, and it's now actually, in terms of level education, knowledge, innovation, creativity, it's actually in a far worse place statistically than it was 1,000 years ago. So you have a tremendous imbalance in the world between the Western European, formerly sort of Christian world, and the Arab Islamic, you know, and it was even more dangerous as the Arab Islamic world has not only gone retrograde in terms of economic and political development, where there's no democracies anymore, anything like that. You have all these offshoots of radical movements that have appeared in the last 50 or so years that are really bad. The biggest, I mean, you have the birth of the Muslim Brotherhood was founded by Hassan al-Banna in 1928. It was more of a social, getting back to pure Islam and more against corruption. A lot of these radical movements started out as social movements to try and better the situation, which they viewed as the corruption of the leadership and things. And then they radicalized into, it's kind of like we get back to our pure roots and it'll be better. But the problem with that is it often ends up being worse. But the real change, Ellie, has been since the Islamic Revolution in 1978, 1979, with Iran, with the Shah falling and Iran coming back as the leader of that radical Shiite movement. That has been incredibly disruptive. And Iran is behind bankrolling and supporting a huge percentage of the terrorism in the world.
Right.
But parallel to that, you've had an emergence of Sunni terrorist organizations, starting like with Al-Qaeda in 1988, with Osama bin Laden. You have ISIS in 2004. You had Hezbollah was founded in like 1985. It was like an offshoot after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. But you have Boko Haram now in 2002. You have a lot of radical, often Salafi is the word. Salafism is a movement of Islam which believes we got to get back to our pure roots. It's almost like being Amish. We got to eschew the technology and the advances and go back. But along with that comes with a lot of, look at the Taliban. You get a lot of this reactionary, closed, oppressive, anti anything changing worldview, which
women can't go to school, they have to cover themselves completely, where
and then they can, and then you can dig deep into, and then you dig deep into the you know, the Islamic ideology of jihad and Dar al-Islam, and you want to remake, you want to jumpstart the caliphate and spread the jihad, and it's a very toxic combination of the, in the case of Iran, it's a pretty powerful, you know, Islamic state that is fomenting this. But in the case of the Sunni movements, it's a lot of these very dangerous Daesh, ISIS, as they call it, or Boko Haram, or, you know, you have, they're really bad news.
But I think it's also worth mentioning, like, one of the things that's been fascinating is that so many pro-Israel demonstrations, there have been staunch Iranians standing with Israel, because they are also trying to revolutionize their own country and get rid of, you know, the Ayatollah. They're trying to oust that situation. So I think that's also very interesting. Again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Like, that there's, they've really been incredibly, like, standing with us as the Persian people, as the Iranians, not wanting to be living under that rule. So that's been really fascinating to see. It has there ever been a democratic Muslim state?
There's states that have had, like Turkey's had elections. Now it's kind of like what Putin is. It's technically a democracy, but it's not. It's a one-party state where they have elections, but they don't mean anything. So, so yes, Turkey did have. What used to be in Turkey, by the way, for years before the Turkey went from being a when the Ottoman Turkish Empire fell apart and Kemal Atatürk founded the modern Republic of Turkey. He secularized and westernized the state. Let's use English as the English letters as the language, instead of Arabic. Let's dress people as Westerners, and the army would constantly, for many many years, which had very close relations with Israel, by the way, interfere and basically overrule the election results if it went to the Islamic side, because the army was staunch secularist. Erdogan has now gotten rid of that and completely controls everything.
Right.
So you see that. And you're saying, by the way, with Iran, Persians are interesting. That it wasn't. The Shah was not a democracy. He was the dictator. And his father was a dictator. But Iran is not an Arab state. Iran is Persia. Persia is a very ancient and highly developed culture with a lot of beauty and positive things in it. Yeah. And whereas it's been hijacked by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and a power elite that runs everything, a lot of Iranians really just want to get back to normalcy. And Iran, by the way, had great relations with Israel during the Shah. They were military allies even.
That's fascinating.
So that's how Shah thinks. People don't realize how the relationships have changed. So,
and was, but the these Shah, are very traditional. Was the Shah then Sunni?
The Shah, Pahlavi, the Shah, that's a good question. Was the Shah, no, I don't believe he was. He must, because I think Iran is Shiite. I never even thought of that. I would assume he's a Shiite, but just because you're Shiite doesn't mean you have to be an extremist. But I need to check that out. That's a good question.
Fascinating.
But yeah, but what I want to say, I just flew out of my brain.
And just to say, like, I want to point out, because we were talking about radicalization, there, like you said, there is radicalization. Radicalization is a possibility in any religion or somewhere where people have incredibly strong beliefs, right? You can have radicalization in the environmental movement. You can have radicalization in Christianity with the Crusades. You can have radicalization even in, you know, sometimes in the religious community with Jews, right? Where they're beating each other up sometimes over, you know, what time mincha is. So, like, you can have radicalization in lots of ways. It isn't only in the Muslim faith, but what we're talking about is the what comes sometimes from that radicalization, and often is the case with any kind of radicalization, fanatical beliefs often produce, you know, violent behaviors.
Exactly. But you say with the Christian world, Jews don't have tradition. You have in the Second Temple period, interesting fighting, at least the violence before the destruction of the Second Temple. Christian world had it, but because the Christian world is so much less Christian, These are not, these are, you know, the Protestant Catholic thing, the religion is just a veneer to fight over power control. And it's a longstanding dispute that goes back, but it's not so much over theological issues as it used to be over big. And even the theological debates were largely about power control, Catholic Spain versus Protestant England and Holland breaking away. So it's never one thing. But in the Islamic world, the biggest thing that drives me really crazy, besides people like in the West spouting off about things they have no idea about, from the river to the sea and Israel occupation and the Arab Palestinians are the indigenous and a whole bunch of nonsense, is the West's propensity to kind of almost condescendingly not take other people's beliefs, be they political or ideologically, as serious. Meaning, if we think, like, people in the West think, you just really want to be like us. You just really want to have an
open, you don't really society. Mean that when you say you don't that. Really mean to
be, and they really do mean it. Islam is, in general, an extremely highly particularistic worldview until today. And the more extreme, and because of one of the reasons why we continue to see the extremism in Islam, is because it has a basis of worldview that can be put, you can really pull into it a lot of pretty like confrontational expansionist radical ideas out of it. And if you want to interpret them in the most extreme way, you can really fire up your population on the theology. But it's a massive mistake to somehow condescendingly tell people who really do believe what they believe that they really don't believe what they believe. That's also a potentially fatal mistake.
Right.
Because these are people who, you know, oh, if I'm just nice to you, you'll like me and you'll blend with me. No, a lot, some will, sure. A lot of Muslims are happy to just be, they fled the places they came from because they didn't want the extremism and the intolerance and the lack of women's rights or whatever place they came from and the poverty of these third world countries they're escaping from. But first of all, a lot of their kids are back into it again. That's an interesting side thing. You know, the parents fled and the kids are radicalized because it's easy as a young person to be on fire, you know, and all excited about ideology. But we really need to work on understanding about Islam. It's not about judging. It's about understanding who you're dealing with. If you're in business, you're about to go into negotiations, you would want to know how the person you're negotiating with thinks and looks at the world. And we need, it's also explained what is realistic and what's not realistic and how to deal with things. So even understanding how in the Middle East, like I said previously, when you offer something in negotiations in the West, it's a sign of good faith. In the Middle East, it's a sign of weakness. It's part of the culture that predates Islam. You have to begin from a position of exaggerated demands, which is why the West putting pressure on Israel to give up stuff is viewed like, you know, you could just see the Hamas guys in their bunkers and underneath saying, yeah, we can count on, you know, we're going to survive this. It ain't going to be militarily, but we can count on the West with their misplaced good hearts and misunderstanding of what's going on to pressure Israel using a Western paradigm to be nicer. So it'll end up, that'll be a disaster. And Israel knows, at least Israel gets that point. So this is the importance of talking about issues that you can't necessarily talk about today because they're not PC or, oh my God, you can't say that, but you have to. That's why I don't like politically correct. I say,
I also think we're talking about the foibles and the dangers of fanaticism in general. You know, every time we talk about this, I keep imagining, like, if anybody here has ever seen the movie Elizabeth, with what's her name?
Which about Elizabeth the First?
Yeah,
it was Kate Winslet. Kate Winslet, Kate Blanchett.
Kate Blanchett. So Elizabeth with Kate Blanchett, if you want to see what religious fanaticism looks like, say in the Christian world, where they're literally hunting each other down and stabbing each other in the halls of the palace and burning people at the stake and rounding them up and shaving their heads and doing terrible things to them. Like, you can look at that film and see any type of, you know, religious fanaticism ends up in people doing things that are deeply anti-religious. And it's just, and I think it's important that people understand, you know, oh, that's the olden days where people didn't know much. No, that's the outgrowth of any type of religious fanaticism. I mean, look, all we have to do is look at any of the, whether it was a terror attack on home soil in America by the Unabomber who blew up, you know, this whole government building because he was fanatic, right? Like, it's not just mental illness, it's fanaticism, and that there's a difference between those things. So I think we don't take into account that fanaticism in any way often ends up, you know, bloody. So It's an interesting thing, I think, that we forget about. You're right. In the Western world, we're assuming that everybody wants to play nice and eventually get to a good place of peace and love and tolerance for otherness. And I think we're mistaken sometimes at that.
Oh, yeah. And then, by the way, Hitler is the best example of Europe appeasing him. We'll just give him a little more and leave us alone because he really wants justice. No, you should listen to what people say. Hitler's very open of what he said. You should listen to what people say of any radical situation. Listen to what Iran says. Iran means it. The great Satan is America. The little Satan is Israel. You know, they are not just saying this for public consumption. They mean what they say, and they plan right to act on it. To not take people's ideology seriously could be a fatal mistake.
Okay, so I feel like we kind of gave a bit of info, background information, a little bit to try to understand exactly what are we navigating right now in the world. And I think also, you know, trying not to bash any particular religion or belief system, but to really understand how, you know, extremism in any place often doesn't end up, you know, doing well for anybody, and to be able to start to understand the background of who is it exactly that's going after Israel, and how do we start to figure out how to deal with that? Anything else that we should know before we wrap up for today?
I'm just last closing thought I have on the Middle East. You see that all conservative societies, you see this with the ultra-Orthodox world in Israel, they change very slowly, mm-hmm. but there's always pressure to change. And to get societies like this to change, you have to, you really, it needs to be done very delicately without coercion and without force. Mm-hmm. On one hand, you wanted to figure out how to, you could see how ready the Middle East, even very traditional Muslim countries, you know, like UAE, Saudi Arabia, these are very traditional places. They're not going to be running around the women in bikinis on the beach, you know, but slowly the best way to ensure stability, by the way, is of course to create wealth and prosperity. When people have what to lose, they're not mm-hmm. so quick to lose it. You know, right. Radicalism, extremism always breeds best in situations of desperation and poverty right. and conflict. So it's just very important that the, you know, the world recognize that the Middle East is a very volatile place, but a place that it can't turn its back on. There's a tremendous amount of potential there, but there's also a tremendous amount of danger there. And Israel is not the cause of it. It's actually, I would say, the first line of defense against what is potentially, because of its history and what's going on there, arguably the most explosive place in the world could be that part of the world. So that's
meaning
if
the rubric that they're working on is the enemy of my enemy is my friend, when that enemy, God forbid, if Israel were to be wiped off the map, there wouldn't necessarily be peace in the Middle East.
The Middle East would explode. What keeps the Middle East from exploding is Israel. Not only because it lets them concentrate their vitriol and hatred on the Jewish people in Israel, but it also, Israel keeps the balance. Countries know they can't go too far because Israel might react. And it's happened. We've done in the past, and it would happen now. So a strong Israel is actually a strong Israel, and an Israel that is a role model of a state that is a state with a faith. You know, a religious state. It's not a democratic state, but a state that is based on faith and history of an indigenous population that is democratically developed, technologically developed, culturally developed, and tolerant is a role model. Trust me, even a lot of the enemies of Israel in the Middle East, they say, we don't like the Jews, but we're really impressed by the judiciary and the fact that they throw prime ministers in jail when they live in worlds that are right. totally corrupt. And so being a good role model in a bad mm-hmm. neighborhood is also a very, very positive thing. And we can just hope that with you know, this current conflict's ending, that Israel will lead the forefront of a slow change and normalization of relations between Israel and the Arab world, but also the move of a lot of the Arab world into a more normative state where they preserve their own unique identity, but they're right. are more right. open, inclusive, and cooperative with the rest of the world. And that would allow Islam to express itself in a far more moderate way, rather than letting it be hijacked by the most extreme people, who I'm sure a lot of Muslims are really not happy that they're suffering the brunt of what other people who claim to represent their faith are doing in their name when they themselves don't espouse acting in the same way. So it's complicated on every level.
Yeah. Awesome. Please, we implore people who are listening, if you have questions, if you have comments, please leave us a comment. If you're listening on Spotify, there's a place to do that. Otherwise, you can look in the liner notes and there are ways to get in touch with both Ken and myself. We want to hear from you. And if you have topic ideas or something you want us to delve into or that you want Ken to talk about in greater detail, please let us know. We love hearing from all of you. I think that's it for today. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.